A diagnosis of breast cancer can cause a life-changing ripple effect of impact, affecting those we love the most and those upon whom we lean, for comfort and strength in the most challenging of times. My name is Aisling Hurley and I'm the CEO of Breast Cancer Ireland, and you're listening to More Than a Lump, a podcast that talks openly and honestly to a selection of guests about their very personal connections to breast cancer, be it through their career choice, their own first-hand experience of the disease, or through sharing the experience of close family members. My conversations will centre on how breast cancer has informed their perspective on life, love, family, health, their goals and indeed their aspirations. Although each story is utterly unique, the one common thread that runs through each one is that breast cancer is more than a lump. This episode of More Than a Lump is proudly supported by Goodbody, a leading financial services firm that has been serving and growing client relationships for nearly 150 years. Breast Cancer Ireland is one of the strategic charity partners that Goodbody works with in an effort to provide educational resources and financial support. I'm joined today by Stephen Kelly and Jamie Crawford. They are married to Tanya and Georgie, both of whom were diagnosed with breast cancer, and both have travelled with their wives along their paths to recovery. I've asked Stephen and Jamie to share their perspective because I believe their insights and experiences will give some support and comfort to other partners during this challenging time. 1 in 9 women diagnosed in their lifetime, but in reality, there is very little information available for partners. Stephen and Jamie, you're both very welcome to More Than a Lump, and thank you for agreeing to come in today and chat to me and to our listeners.
Thanks for having us.
Jamie, starting with you, we all know and love Georgie, and we're all so proud of all that she's achieved with the support and help, of course, through her Good Glow podcast, and we're so appreciative of everything she has done for us as an ambassador for Breast Cancer Ireland. But take us back to those early days, and what was going through your mind that night that Georgie showed you the lump?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for giving us this space to talk from a partner's point of view. I remember, you know, as we were going through it with Georgie, it was probably 3 or 4 months in before anyone actually turned around to me and said, "How are you doing?"
Yeah.
And when they actually did, that's when I sort of broke down a little bit, because that was my first opportunity to really express myself and tell people how I was feeling, because I had to be strong for Georgie. So, you know, I think this is really important. So first of all, thank you so much for that. Going back to your question, on the night in that Georgie found the lump, my initial reaction was go to the logical space, which is Georgie was quite young. She was only 32 at the time, and she just finished breast feeding. She'd done it for 6 months. This was month 7. She, you know, it was probably something to do with the change between stopping breastfeeding and going back to kind of bottle feeding Pia the whole time. So I initially didn't really panic. Obviously, when I felt the lump, it felt very hard. It felt quite alien, and I did get a fright. But my initial thoughts were, no, this, you're too young. This isn't generally what happens. And I know it is, you know, the perception out there is that it doesn't happen to young people, but it does.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that at the time. So, you know, I'm quite risk adverse. So my first thing was like, get into the doctor tomorrow morning straight away. We'll get it checked. You'll be fine. You'll be out. You'll be grand by next week. They'll rule everything out, and that'll be it. And that was kind of my reaction. And I kind of stayed quite practical and pragmatic. Georgie was panicking, and I kind of said, look, if I get panicked as well, that's not going to help anyone here. So we got an appointment, luckily, with the GP that morning, and then the next morning she still wasn't happy with what the GP had said, and the GP had kind of said to us, look, maybe go to a breast clinic and get a check. So we rang around at the time, got a clinic appointment in the clinic in Beaumont, went straight out there the Friday morning. And that's when the whole process started to get more serious.
And how did you feel? Like, I know you tried to, you know, you get into, you know, it's fight or flight.
Yeah.
So you get into fight mode, and you try to be there and be the rock. But what was going through your head?
As the Friday progressed, then I started to get quite worried, because I could see the medical process evolving, getting a little bit more serious as we were going. And the lowest point in the whole process for me was the Saturday night. So Georgie found the lump on the Wednesday evening. The Thursday we were in the GP. The Friday we were in Beaumont. And she had a biopsy that day. And she thought she had a different type of biopsy than she did. So she was going to Dr. Google, which we all know is not a good place to go.
No.
She started reading, started to panic. She started to, she fainted at one point. She just got in such a bad way. And then that's when that kind of got in on me. And I started to feel like really scared, worried, panicked for the future. Like, we just had our first baby, you know, anyone that has had their first child, it's like an amazing experience. Mm-hmm. It's just like you've never felt love like that in your life before. Mm-hmm. And we'd both been in an incredibly happy, beautiful place. We just bought our ideal house. Life was just amazing. And then bang, the sledgehammer came. So I remember going out into the back garden and ringing my sister, who was kind of like my go-to in a time of need, and like breaking down completely. I remember kneeling down on the grass and just falling into tears, and I said, I need you to come up to me, like I need you now, like. And my sister came up, and Georgie's mum came up, and between the two of them they settled the two of us. And if I'm honest with you, whatever happened that night, I wasn't ever that bad again since.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, you just had to,
yeah, I had to go to that moment to come back to out come of back it, again, you know,
and
I mean,
feel a bit stronger. I mean, Dr. Google, I suppose, is horrendous. Because unfortunately, you don't know what you're dealing with. You're going and saying, you know, I found a lump, what could it be? And it gives you a myriad of explanations. Some of them are harrowing. When in actual fact, I suppose, and we have learned with all the research that has gone on, and even in the last 10 years, that now patients that are diagnosed, it's a very personal treatment plan. No two people have the same treatment plan. So I've often talked to a group of women, and maybe they are triple negative breast cancer patients. And one will say, you know, well, my chemo was 12 weeks, my chemo was 6 weeks. Oh, mine must have been so much worse than yours. It doesn't matter. It's based on your own genetic profiling, which is super that we have that personalized ability to be able to say that. But and it does in time, it does relieve people a little bit. But Dr. Google is horrendous. You know, I often say to people, if you're going to go anywhere, you know, go to the likes of the Mayo Clinic or go to the likes of Breast Cancer Now, really, you know, established organizations that don't put the fear of God in you, but that tell you in very plain English what it can be. They also aren't scaremongering, because that's, you'll be up and down the walls, you know, wondering what if and how come, and you have to wait a certain period of time for biopsies to come back. But in that same time, your head is in a spin dryer.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah. And so, Steve, you too also, tell me about Tanya's and how you felt initially.
Well, I think similarly challenging. And again, thanks for giving us a chance just to share what it's like. I mean, the burden is definitely on the person that's diagnosed, but there's another view, another challenge when you're trying to support that person. So really appreciate it. We found out a year and a half ago. So it was not even a year and a half ago, just over a year ago. Mm-hmm. It's funny, the contrasts. We had been through a slightly different time. My younger sister had passed away not long before. I'd been through a really, really challenging time in business. I had to close down a company, and we were kind of getting through that. And Tiny had a slightly different situation. She was in her late, mid to late 40s, 47. But never had an illness, wasn't the kind of person that would be in hospital or no underlying conditions. She wasn't a smoker, a heavy drinker, nothing unusual that would give you. And she would have had a history, I suppose, of just being a bit cystic. So some kinds of lumps from time to time wouldn't have been unusual. Mm. So we didn't probably have the same shock that, oh, it's a lump and God knows what it is. And also one thing I learned is, it's really funny you said more than just a lump is the title of the podcast. Tanya's lump wasn't like a lump. I think we have a perception that it's a little golf ball, and hers was lobular, and it was described as like a little string of beads. Wow. So it's not always what you expect to find. So I didn't have the same experience of her saying, feel this unique, you know, identifiable thing. But she was suspicious. she just had kind of a dimpling effect as well. So went to the doctor, went for a scan. And again, that's when they start to kind of give you that little bit of extra care, and you worry that something's wrong, and they say, can you come in again? And we want to do a biopsy. And so I think once they've taken the biopsy, you start to worry. And I think that first kind of week or 10 days where they're doing the biopsy, you're waiting for the results, then they do the results. And I think what people don't realize is you get the bad news, but then they do more scans. So they scan for any other type of cancer. So they'll do scans of, you know, your full abdominal scan, they'll do bloods, and they'll look for it anywhere else that it might have, you know, might have traveled. Mm-hmm. So you've got more and more phases of worry. And I think that first phase is definitely the most difficult, you know, definitely like for us, once you've got through that phase, which is horrendous, we didn't know how to deal with it. We didn't expect it. We had enough to deal with already. So you sit at home thinking, like, how many more things can happen? Mm-hmm. Our kids were older. So they're now kind of 9, 12 and 14. So a year ago, just a little bit younger, but still old enough that you have to worry about them, take care of them, get them to school. Mm-hmm. It's a busy house, busy lifestyle. So we sat there just scratching our heads, wondering what to do. And you kind of wonder how it happened. It's something you expect isn't going to happen to you.
No family history.
Well, actually, that's not entirely true. Tanya's father had cancer, but kind of lung cancer and probably smoking related. Mm-hmm. There was cancer in my family, but different side of the family. So in her family, there were some, but not a kind of history of predictable breast cancer in any kind of way, but some cancers,
I mean, and statistically, only 5% of the population have a hereditary breast cancer. Yeah. But oftentimes, you know, it is out of the blue, or there can be some instances where an aunt or an aunt on a father's side, etc. And in hindsight, people say, oh, OK. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's a fantastic family history clinic that I know is in Beaumont, where oftentimes if I talk to younger women, especially, is, you know, if you have any other siblings that have had, or, you know, anybody related to you, you should at least contact this centre, because they do analyse, they questionnaire, they fill all of those blanks in, and they weigh you on, say, medium risk, high risk, low risk, you know, as to whether or not you should be concerned. And anyone that is a high risk is obviously looked after and mammogrammed at least, or, you know, looked, has a mammogram every six months. Mm. How did you tell your children? Because they were of an age to understand. I mean, Pia for Jamie was very, very young at 7 months, but how did you tell the kids?
Yeah, it's a different type of worry, because I can understand, you know, I've been through that new parent thing. You worry in a different way because the child doesn't understand and you don't know how you're going to deal with it. We had to do the opposite and tell the children. And we decided to tell the children. So unfortunately, we had a couple of friends that had been through the same thing. So we had a couple of reference points, and one close friend was exactly 1 year ahead of Tanya in a very, very similar kind of diagnosis. And they had chosen not to tell the kids directly at the time, and, you know, let it come out by osmosis. And I think you have to do what you're comfortable with yourself, because you might not be comfortable having the conversation and the kids will, you know, feel insecure from that conversation. We decided to tell them for a couple of reasons. We figured they'd hear it, they'd find out, and then it might upset them more. And I did say to the kids, you know, mum isn't well, but you're constructive. You know, there's treatment and she's going to be fine. I think by the time we told them, we knew it was operable and the prognosis was good. So we were lucky in a way that it looked like we were going to get through this, albeit a rocky road. Mm-hmm. So we told the kids and we told them it was cancer, just in case. We said, you know, our eldest kid, our daughter, Amy, you know, she could quite easily find out later and say, well, you never said it was cancer. So we decided it was good just to kind of come clean, but simple and age appropriate and kind of constructive, or almost positive, you know, we'll get through this. Mm-hmm. The other thing we said was a bit like their own friends, different people will react differently. And I think what's funny is some of the most, you know, balanced, calm people, you know, will arrive at the door and burst into tears, you know. So we had this experience of not knowing how people would react. And I had a conversation with Tanya, which is, we're now, you know, going to brave up and deal with this, and we'll have to, and we will, and it'll be fine, and it'll be hard, but we'll get there. But what'll upset you is people will come to the door and totally break down. You'll be supporting them, you know.
Yeah.
So we said that to the kids. We said, like your own friends, some of them have different ways of doing things in the playground or on the football pitch. Some of them get very angry. Mm-hmm. Some of them get very upset if they lose. And sure enough, my middle fella Harvey came into me one day and he said, well, you were right, Dad. And I said, what happened? And he said, well, there's two of them crying in the kitchen, you know. So so somebody had arrived, all happy, trying to be positive. Bunch of flowers, coffee, let's have a chat. And within 5 minutes, cheers. It was all
Yeah.
And that happens and it's fine. Yeah. You know, it's fine. Absolutely. But I wanted them to know that that hasn't changed what we said to you. That's yes. going to happen.
Yes, know? Exactly. And it's strange, you know, I often talk to some girls and they say, you know, you get the tilt head. Oh,
yeah.
And, you know, and I'm thinking, well, people are upset for you. It's strange how people react, you know, and you suddenly realize when you're going through it and friends, they find it difficult. They yeah. don't know what to say. They want to be there for you. They want to support you. But they don't know really what to do and what to say and what's the right thing to say or the wrong thing to say. It's a tough one. It's yeah. a tough one.
People empathize with you and they say, oh, I was through something similar and it was a broken toe. You know, yeah. like, yeah. okay, it's not quite the same. You know, I was yeah. in Vincent's and I had this doctor and he did a great job. Yeah. So you have to kind of, I guess you have to be non-judgmental because that's just human nature. People are just trying to, you know, bond with you, help you, tell you what's going to be okay, you mm. know.
And I suppose then when Tanya was diagnosed, it was through COVID.
Yeah.
Pandemic times when things were a lot more restrictive and locked down. How did you deal with that?
God, I think my first worry was quite transactional, which is, will I be allowed to get involved in this process at all? Will I be in the hospital? Will I be able to meet the consultant or, you know, an oncologist? What will I, you know, how can I help? Will I just be sitting outside in the car hoping I can, you know, understand what went on? Mm-hmm. But I was lucky. By the time we went in, we were able to go in together. I'm not sure if that was, you know, by the rule book or not, but we were masked and you know,
yeah.
all very carefully controlled, 6 feet apart.
Mm-hmm.
But I was able to go there. And I guess the one thing for me was it was important to be there. Now, I would have FOMO, so I would want to be there. Mm-hmm. So, and I like to know what's going on. And Tanya's a nurse, so she's okay. very comfortable with the terminology. So she'll go off on a tangent and they'll be talking about blood types and different procedures and it'll all be in Latin, you know. Mm-hmm. But for me, if there's a question that she wants to ask when you're under pressure, you nearly always forget. And the number of times, you probably had the same thing, but yeah. the number of times, you know, Tanya would say, make sure I ask them about that other procedure they mm-hmm. mentioned, because we never went there, and we'd yeah. get through the whole consultation and it would never come up, and I would just gently chime in and say, you wanted to ask yeah. one extra thing, you know.
Yeah.
You don't want to interfere, but sometimes it's good.
That is very true, because in talking to people, the first thing they hear is cancer, and for the patient that is like, oh my God, and they have to process that
yeah.
and therefore everything else is like just white noise. Yeah. They don't really understand what's going on. Yeah. So it is really important to have that other sounding board that's there to kind of say, or listen mm-hmm. to what the consultant is saying, you know, listen yeah. to the sort of the treatment plan and everything. Because I think I've had one or two ladies who've said to me, you know, I didn't hear anything after they yeah. said cancer. And my husband got such a fright, he didn't hear, or my partner yeah. didn't hear. Whereas it is important if you're going, you know, to have somebody with you that is there, you know, initially, you know, pad and pencil, just yeah, write it down so that you get everything that's being said and then come away and can have that informed conversation, you know. And I suppose the telling the children part is something that I always find with various different people. And as you say, it has to be age appropriate and it has to be according to how you live your life and your own family circumstances, etc. Because there has been times when, you know, especially teenage kids, you know, trying to tell teenage kids, and immediately then they're going back into school and they're talking, and, you know, kids are kids, they don't understand the full remit of everything, and they go away saying, well, my auntie had it and she did this, or my auntie did this, and then my auntie died, and yeah. all of a sudden kids are, could my mom die or could this person die? So there is that fine line, as you say, of how to handle it carefully.
Yeah, I think you're right, and you kind of have to prep them for that, you know, and again, it's back to how people react. People will say the wrong or different thing. The other thing we said to them is, you know, cancers are quite different. Mm-hmm. There's a myriad of different types of cancers, from skin cancer to lung cancer to breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And this particular type is treatable, you know. Mm-hmm. We knew someone who had died of breast cancer. So we had, again, that example where we could say it's different to what Liz had, you know. Mm-hmm. So this close friend died of breast cancer. So we'd kind of been through, as a friend, we'd been through some of the journey before, and we were able to say to the kids, it's different, because our youngest, Zach, would have been very young at that stage. He mightn't remember, but he'd hear it from the others. So we wanted just to mm-hmm. set the level playing field, mm-hmm. you know.
And do you feel that there was a good support for you both? Do you think there should be something else that's done for, as we call it, partners in cancer, which is a very loose term, but do you think there should be some kind of support there to help those who are partners and the families cope with somebody that's close to them having a cancer diagnosis?
For my perspective, I definitely think that there should be a little bit more focus, or a different focus, if you put it that way, on the partners and what they're going through and how they're dealing with it. Because, you know, every scenario is different. Yours was obviously different to mine. We had a 7-month-old. I was like, okay, I need to do all the night feeds. I need to be awake all the time. And not that I would have changed how I managed any of that, but over time it chipped away at me, and I started to, you know, my own health suffered a little bit, mm-hmm. and you end up, you know, my own mental health suffered a little mm-hmm. bit towards the end of everything, and you end up sort of not putting any focus on yourself. But if you have a support network, or you have a particular service that can come and support you, that just reminds you to mm-hmm. navigate and manage mm-hmm. the situation for you both.
Absolutely.
As opposed to just having the focus on one person. Not
absolutely.
That you would do it differently, but, you know.
Mm-hmm. Because it does. I mean, while it impacts the patient physically, the ripple effect, we call this the ripple effect. The ripple effect is right across through the, you know, the partners, the families, the community, the friends. You know, everybody has that knock-on effect of being impacted by this person that they love who has breast cancer. And it is important, I think, that there is a support for people there, whether it is a group that get together and just say, you know what, it's okay to feel a little bit, you know, angry. It's okay to feel upset. It's okay to, you know, question, you know, what's going to happen next, you know, and we're here for each other.
Yeah.
You know, I think that is important. And, you know, I know I remember two or three years ago, I had a lady who her husband contacted me, and he said, Aisling, what am I going to do? He said, I have to call you separately and privately to her knowing, because he said she'll go bananas. But he said, she's really not coping well, and I'm not coping well. And I remember Emma Hannigan, Lord of Mercy on her dad saying to me that he lives in Bray, and he said right next door was a crowd called Purple House. And mm-hmm. he said they're amazing counselling and support services for families of people who have affected by cancer, whether it's grief counselling or, you know, just counselling in general of how to talk to kids, etc. And I thought, there we go, I'm going to call them. So I rang them, and I have to say, they were amazing. Mm-hmm. And I told them the situation of this other lady. Now, she has a stage 4 diagnosis. And they immediately said, she'd been trying to get on to another group that were look after counselling. But they immediately said, just tell her, phone us. We'll look after her straight away, and we look after the family. That's so important to have that kind of resource there to help people.
Yeah, I think it's kind of mentally and physically tiring. For me, a bit like yourself, I just threw myself into keeping the family going, you know. I had a bit of time off, so that was kind of fortuitous. But I was 24 hours a day on with the 3 kids. And, like, I wouldn't change that, you know, and I wouldn't. But it was definitely busy. When I look back now, you know, I was, you know, trying to do everything. And you have to be positive all the time. There's no other alternative. If you're negative, you might as well just roll over. And so we actually decided to try and, you know, a number of people said to us, you're doing too much. But we didn't really have another option, because we decided we wanted the kids to go to school and do their football and swimming and whatever else they're doing, and not have the diagnosis interfere with them, or for them to think, oh, this is a problem. We can't function. So rightly or wrongly, and everyone does it differently. I mean, you have your own situation and your own support network. But we decided we would try and keep everything going. So it just became inordinately busy for like 9 months, I would say. It's calmed down a lot now.
Yeah.
And there's times when Tanya wasn't able to function properly, or to drive, or to do anything. Or she might, but I couldn't rely on her having a good day. And that's no disrespect to her. She mightn't have a good day. So if she says, don't worry, I'll go and you take a break that day.
Mm-hmm.
So I just tried to do everything, not trying to be a hero, but I just, my default was to cover the bases. So it's tiring and stressful, and you are, within that, you're trying to be positive all the time.
Yeah.
You know, I found when people ask you how you're doing, I'm fine. How's Tanya doing? She's doing great.
Yeah.
She's doing great. Because you almost don't want to doubt yourself, you know?
Yeah. I think for me, the big thing that I noticed was actually when it was all over, that's when I started to go down a little bit from a mental point of view, because you're in the cycle, you're in the process, you've got appointment, you've got to get the kids to football,
yeah.
you know, I got to, you know, get PE into a creche, got to do the nappies, do all this sort of stuff. So you're just going, 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 going. And within that, you might have your bad day And then you pull yourself back up because life gets busy again, or you've got another appointment or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's when all the appointments, for me, it was when all the appointments stopped and everything went kind of quiet. And it was like, okay, you know, Georgie's treatment was over. Kind of, you know, she was given the green light that life is good again. And kind of, actually, that's when the sledgehammer came and hit me a bit. Yeah. I was just like, what just happened over the last year or so? Yeah. That's when I kind of went down a little bit from a mental point of view and just kind of was, I suppose, reliving the situation to sort of clarify it all in my mind and be like, why did this happen us? How did this happen us? You know, mm-hmm. whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think if I could give any one advice coming out of the treatment process and all that sort of stuff is that, you know, that's when you need to be very aware of yourself, your feelings, the way you're feeling, why you're feeling like that, and sort of do a bit of work on that side of things.
Mm-hmm. And did either of you ever sort of do anything to relieve that? So, you know, when you get so, I know, for instance, in my own world, that when I get really stressed, you know, my voice goes all really creaky. I have to get out and get air. I have to go for a run or go for a walk or do something. Otherwise, I'll just, you know, internally combust. Is there anything that you did find that you could relieve yourself away from that situation to give you space?
I don't think so. And that's probably maybe a flaw. You know, my experience was I probably didn't. And people come to you very kindly and they say, you know, after the first few months, like you said, people say, well, how are you doing? You know, it takes a while. And I wasn't looking for anything, but it was kind of people to say, how are you doing? I didn't really know how to react and say, no, I'm doing fine. You know, I won't be beaten either. I'll be fine, you know, but you're tired and you're being brave and positive. I don't think I did anything to relieve that stress. And with hindsight, maybe you should. I think one of the problems is you don't know what you don't know. So you gradually, you know, you land in this situation, you gradually get busier. It becomes more immersive when the treatment comes along. And that's when you're needed most, because you have to manage the house and try and make sure that mom is okay in and out of the hospital, whatever the treatment is. And that happens and is upon you before you realize it. And you don't plan for it. So you don't plan for breaks or relief or time out. And yeah, maybe you should, you know. I mean, I probably enjoyed being busy. It was a healthy distraction, but it also can be damaging, can be difficult for you.
Yeah, the biggest mistake I made was not doing anything not for myself, but like taking that moment where I might go for a run just to get air, like you said, get outside, get outdoors, just get away from everything for a little bit. I just was like, no, I'm fine. I'll just keep going, just keep plowing on like you did. Just get stuck in, just go, you know, do the things, change the nappies, make sure he has her dinner, you know, all that sort of stuff.
You're just on this roller coaster.
Yeah. And, you know, that is definitely not the right thing to do. And if you do have a good support network around you, which we did and still do, an amazing support network. But I never really asked them for help because I didn't want to be seen to be asking for help, or I kind of felt a bit like, no, like I wanted them to feel like I was strong enough for Georgie, so they weren't worrying about her and me being strong enough, you know, that kind of way.
Yeah.
So
that's a really good point. I think that subconsciously what you're doing is
you're
displaying the fact that you're taking care and nobody needs to worry. Yeah. Don't worry, I have it all in hand, you know. Yeah.
So, you know, it's the age old problem with men. They, you know, particularly they won't ever ask for help. Yeah. But the biggest mistake I made was not going, you know, on a Tuesday night, would it be okay if you came down to the house for 2 hours and I go for a run or just go for a coffee or go whatever for a pint with the lads or whatever, just to have some sense of normality to rebalance the situation.
And I suppose, well, I know with Georgie's treatment, I know she had nearly like a party to do her the whole shave the head, you know, with the chemotherapy. Yeah. How was did Tanya go through chemo?
She did. And they were very clear that, I wish I could remember the names now, but there was two drugs and the combination that she had was binary. It would be hair off within two weeks.
Okay.
And that was a bit shocking. Tanya would be known for like long blonde flowing locks. It's lovely. Part of her look. She's very distinctive. So for her not to have that would, but I guess like anybody, you know, it's not great. We were warned that it'll start to fall out. And I think one of the reasons we're warned is you can kind of prolong it, but on a daily basis, it becomes psychologically very hard to see these, you know, literally chunks of hair coming out. Mm-hmm. the doctor, who is a male oncologist, so you wonder if he really understands, but I guess he was right. He'd seen it so many times. He's like, there's a point where I'd recommend you just take it off. Mm-hmm. And because of Tanya's hair, loads of people kind of sympathetically said, oh, no, don't do that. But I kind of gave her a wink and a nudge, and I said, I think there might be a hint of wisdom in this, you know. So eventually we sat down one day, and I would be a failed artist in many ways, but hairdressing is definitely a failure of mine, for me or anyone else or any one of the children. So I told Tanya, don't worry, I'll cut your hair into a bob. It was a disaster. And within
Peter
24
Marks
hours...
Peter Marks can be rest assured.
Absolutely. my CV will not cross their door. And within 24 hours, Tanya said to me, I think I need you to shave it off. So it went. Mm. And interestingly... she looked fine. Like, I think the shock of losing the hair is terrible, and when it comes out in chunks, it looked worse. When we shaved it off, you get over it the first time you look in the mirror, and then her head looked good. She looked quite good. We got a really good wig, and it solved the problem temporarily. And she's now in limbo with the hair growing. So the other thing we were told was, it's binary. The type of treatment you'll have will be hair gone quickly, but hair will grow back quickly.
Okay.
So it's grown back quick and strong.
Great.
So she's got great. Now it's short and it's awkward because it's pushing the wig out of position.
Okay.
So she's now at the point of, well, at what when do I go brave and just go with the short curly hair?
Yeah.
But it's one of those things you just have to deal with when it comes along. It's not great, but my humble opinion would be just there's a point where it's better just to go.
Mm-hmm. And Georgie was the same. I mean, she had beautiful long brown hair, like stunning. I remember seeing the party going, well, that's one way to do it.
But it's funny when you said about your wife's hair being a particular feature. Georgie was always big hair to the point that, like, kind of Marge Simpson stuff at some stage. Like, big hair all the time. Everyone used to be like, how do you get the volume in her hair? So her hair was a big feature for her. And so I remember her calling me. I was in work one day and she called me and said it started to come out, and I went home and had a look, and it had started to come out at the front and gone very thin. And she just was like, right, I want it gone. So, like, that's, you know, Georgie's strength. She's like kind of straight in there being like, okay, we got it. It's got to go. Mm-hmm. So I think we arranged for the hairdresser who did her hair at our wedding to come and shave it and sort of make a bit of a thing about it.
Yeah.
To make it a positive experience, because she was really, really, really anxious about it. But she wanted her, strength around her, support network around the people she cared about the most to be there and, like, to pull her through it. And we had a bit of a party. We put on music and, she just, Danielle, her hairdresser, said, is it time to go to do it now? And she's like, yeah, just do it. Did it, shaved it off, and everyone, the automatic reaction was, oh my God, you're like, you look stunning.
Yes. And
then everyone started going, maybe you should just keep your hair like that, because she still had enough hair that you would see the kind of stubble and stuff that was there. It hadn't fully fallen out at that point. Yeah. So she looked amazing for the first while, and that kind of, everyone, its positivity was really, really good, and that really helped. And that's that, from then on, she's never gone beyond the bob. It's coming back. It's relatively short.
It looks great. Yeah. And I suppose, it is life changing. The diagnosis is certainly life changing. And I suppose, you're, 5-6 years out and you're just only coming through it, Steve. So I suppose, what have you learnt about yourselves in that period? Yours is quite short time. But for you, Jamie, what have you learnt about yourself that you'd like to share with people?
You mentioned something earlier about, staying away from, we talked about staying away from Dr. Google and stuff like that. Any advice I could give to people is do that. One thing that is sort of that I did, and I've spoken about before in a couple of podcasts, was I spent a bit of time doing what you actually advise, which is look at the Mayo Clinic and sites that are reputable. And I went a little bit of a step further of, like, actually trying to read some medical papers about it, because Georgie would be very, she would easily go into a dark place very quickly. And if she's not given solutions and answers and they don't sound logical, then it's hard to get her back out of that point. So, I read a few medical papers and, like, long published articles by doctors and stuff about it. you know, spent a lot of time Googling what the words meant in it, but it all made, started to make a lot of sense for me. So when she went to that dark moment, I had an answer for pretty much every thing that she kind of brought to me, every problem that she brought to me. I had the right stats. I had the right information. I was able to sort of take her down off the edge quite quickly.
Right.
That was one of the things that, you know, I would just stay away from the internet if I was anyone in this situation. But if you feel like you have to go there, go to the right places.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, that was a big one for me.
Mm-hmm.
And any other learnings about myself would have been, I think we said earlier, like, it's okay to ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not.
And you are really resilient.
Less of a man to mm-hmm. ask mm-hmm. for help, or like, you know, you're not less of a partner to put up your hand and say, "Can I get a bit of help here with something?" Yeah. And all that does is actually help the whole situation. Because if you're in a good space, then you're gonna be in a good space for Absolutely. Your partner. Mm-hmm. And if you're kind of hiding it all and kind of putting on this faux positivity or faux whatever. Ultimately, I believe people see right through that anyway over a period of time. So mm-hmm. unless you're doing the stuff in the background to help yourself to stay positive and stay in a good mindset in order to help your partner,
yeah.
then you're not going anywhere. Yeah.
What about you, Steve?
Well, just picking up on that last point about learnings about other people and not just myself. I mean, I think when people offer the help, do accept the help. And we did on some occasions, and I probably didn't really mention that, but we were very lucky that, and maybe it's the age of the family and the kids and some of the people they network with. So friends from school and from sports clubs and just our own kind of friends from years ago, and family would have dropped in food, you know. Mm-hmm. They'd offer you a lift to the pool and every now and then you would take it and it would take a bit of the pressure off. So I think don't be afraid to take that help. And when people come to the door with the lasagna, it's a blessing and it's great. And it's great for them. They want to help, but it's really great for you. Because the one thing that did give me a bit of relief was those few days where it was really, really busy. And I could be in and out of school, you know, runs and in and out of football pitches, etc. And I'd get home, but I knew there was like a lasagna I could put in the oven. Yeah. Or it was just coming out of the oven.
Yeah.
So that was great, because I don't mind cooking, I quite enjoy it, but not having time
mm-hmm.
is a head wreck. But mm-hmm. I think for me, I think probably you learn how resilient you are and maybe where your boundaries are, maybe where you're not resilient. But I think just to give people confidence, you know, humans are probably quite resilient and you'll be okay. So that initial shock is terrible, and it's like a bereavement. And I do think the initial stage is the hardest, you know, the first diagnosis, but you're resilient and you'll get on through it. So have confidence in yourself, but accept the help. I think for men, you know, I'm probably being a bit sexist here, but you know, I am built that way, that I want to fix things. I want to find the solution.
Mm.
So when you hear something is wrong, you're like, okay, Dr. Google or wherever you get it from, how do I fix this? What is it? How do I fix it? And that's probably not really going to help in this situation.
Mm.
You have to do one of those things that you learn over time as an adult, which is to listen, you know, listen to consultants, listen to your wife or your partner, and maybe, yeah, just sit and listen.
Mm-hmm.
Don't speak. Don't try and give a solution. And not speaking for me is really difficult. Like, impossibly
Meet
difficult.
Meet your sister.
So there's times when, and it could be tears, and there's nothing you can say. You know, the tears are genuine. It's just upset. It's just fear. So I think, you know, those are main things. I think the last thing for me is there are times when you can have a sense of humor. It's not all doom and gloom. Because it's horrifically difficult, but life is life and funny things happen and the kids ask ridiculous questions and people say stupid things and, you know, strange things go on and it makes you laugh, you know. And we were in, just after the diagnosis, at that very difficult time, we met a cosmetic surgeon very early on. Brilliant, really nice, really calm guy who's treading very carefully on the whole subject of mastectomy. And Tanya had told me beforehand, I know where this is going. It's a mastectomy and I prefer that. I'm not in for, you know, reducing the operation. I fully understand that if it's a certain size, it has to be a mastectomy. So it was only a question of whether it was one side or two. So it was just one side. So he went through all the options. He went through the fact that he'll make it all look right and balanced and he can do the reconstruction. It was going to be a natural reconstruction. And I didn't realize that they can do the removal, the natural reconstruction, which is basically a tummy tuck, the Dieppe. And he described all of that, and he said, look, we do the lymph nodes at the same time. So he's got a four procedures. It's 10 hours in the operating theatre. But it's amazing what they can do. And he said, then we'll do the reconstruction. So when you come out, it'll all be back where it is. And that's a choice, you know, to do something as major as that. Tanya chose to do it. And there was silence in the room. So she said to him, so does that mean I get the boob job and the tummy tuck that Steve was never going to pay for? So I think it's okay. You know, that's the dark sense of humor, but it's a bit of fun. So, so we went with that. So she went with the tummy tuck and the boob job.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Well, listen, Steve and Jamie, thank you so much for joining today. I think you will allay a lot of fears of partners who are going through this with their loved ones. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us here.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Goodbody, Ireland's longest established stockbroking firm, supporting initiatives that have a lasting impact. The information in this podcast is based on the personal stories of those we have chatted to. If you are concerned in any way, please contact your GP immediately. Or you can contact us at breastcancerireland.com.